This is Radio Frontier Channel for Friday, April 29th, 2005. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Frontier Channel, where we explore the frontiers of science and technology, from outer space to cyberspace and destinations in between. I'm your host, Richard Leese. In this seventh episode of Radio Frontier Channel, I speak with Becca Walker, a graduate student in the geosciences program at the University of Arizona. She has been researching the interaction between scientists and teachers in hopes of better understanding how geology is taught to children. Some teacher-scientist partnerships succeed and some fail miserably. What are the factors involved? We also discuss women in science, public interest in geology, overcoming obstacles, past volcanism in the Tucson, Arizona area, and much more. Please send in your comments after the show. You can leave a voicemail message by calling the Radio Frontier Channel hotline at 206-202-3311. You can also send me email. The address is frontierchannel@frontierchannel.tv. Please vote for Radio Frontier Channel at Podcast Alley, www.podcastalley.com. A direct link to the Podcast Alley listing for Radio Frontier Channel will be provided in the show notes. Want to help support Radio Frontier Channel? Make a PayPal donation on the website. Now for my interview with Becca Walker, conducted in her office at the University of Arizona campus.
I want to welcome Becca Walker to the show. Thank you again for agreeing to the interview.
You're welcome.
You're currently creating your work in graduate studies in geosciences, and your research emphasis is geosciences education.
Right.
Is that correct? How did you get into geology in the first place?
So I went to a small liberal arts school as an undergrad, and you don't have to declare a major. Until you're a sophomore at the school. So everyone goes in undecided, and just, you know, there are a bunch of just general requirements for the liberal arts degree, and then you get specialized in your major. So I was pretty set on being a biology major and doing the pre-med requirements. And I took, you know, I'd always been interested in, I guess, peripherally in earth sciences. You know, I took one class in it in high school. I'm from the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, so we were always collecting fossils and, you know, nerdy stuff like that. But I took an oceanography class, I guess, pretty randomly my freshman year, and loved it. And I loved the, you know, just the mentality of the geology department at the school. And the student population seemed a lot more laid back and a lot less competitive than my classmates in the bio department. So then the next year I took a geology class at the same time as a biology class and said, this is going to make up my mind. And I really did not like the bio class and continued to really love the geology. So I decided to major in that. I wound up fulfilling all of the pre-med requirements, but as I got more and more into geology, I did a research experience for undergrad's program after my junior year in college and decided that I really wanted to go into geology and start grad school. So when I was trying to evaluate what I was going to do after my undergrad, you know, a lot of that was just thinking about, if I do pursue this graduate work in geology, what are my options career-wise? And while I really enjoyed doing the research as an undergraduate, I'd done a lot of tutoring as a high school and a college student and was pretty comfortable with my communication skills. and also really interested in just conveying my excitement and my interest about geology. So I knew that, that teaching was going to be for me. As far as actually deciding to do the research emphasis in geoed, my plan was initially I needed to be really grounded in some kind of a research discipline, but also cultivate those teaching skills. And I thought that by combining, you know, a rigorous research program like at the U of A, but emphasizing in an educational discipline, that would kind of make me a really unique person in terms of a geoscience educator.
And your current research is combining that too, what with the CAPS program. I went to that GeoDays presentation and watched you. Number one, your presentation skills are amazing.
Oh, thanks.
You're really comfortable, it seems.
Yeah.
The title of it was The Evolution of Science Teacher Partnerships, a Case Study Investigation. What dynamic are you studying there?
So you've gone to the CATS website, so I'm not really going to give background about that program, but these partnerships between scientists and K-12 teachers are becoming more and more common because, as sad as it is, the majority of K-12 earth science teachers have no previous training in earth science. And there was actually just an article about that in the paper a couple days ago. This teacher his training was in political science, the administration at his high school has determined that he is one of their most qualified earth science teachers. So he's doing the class, and the quote under the headline was, "I feel like I'm letting the students down." Because, I mean, he knows that he has no grounding in this discipline, but he's the most qualified for some reason. So,
And this is one of the few countries that trains teachers in that way, really. Like, most countries, they have a background in what they end up teaching, and here we don't necessarily do that.
Right. So these scientists from either university or industry or even government scientists are coming into these classrooms and trying to increase the quantity and quality of science that's taught in the K-12 system. But as you can imagine, that's very intimidating and very alienating for a lot of teachers to essentially have a stranger come in and say, you know, I don't necessarily have the teaching experience or the teaching skills that you have, but I'm an expert in science, so this is how you're going to be running your classroom this year. So the pre-existing body of knowledge about these partnerships, most of the literature discusses, you know, here's a description of a partnership program that we've established, and here are the results, here are the impacts. And that's great, but there hasn't been very much, scholarly work done on, okay, well, it has all these great benefits, but how do you actually develop a sustainable relationship with mutual trust and respect between these two very different cultures of science and teaching? So what I have done in my research is kind of track a bunch of different CAPS program partnerships and look for what works and what doesn't work. And if barriers are met in the context of the partnership, which invariably that's what happens, are certain barriers able to be overcome? And if so, what are some of the strategies for overcoming those?
What were some of the problems with partnerships that you ran into before we get to some of the good partnerships?
Some of the good. Okay, so I guess I want to backtrack a little bit. I use a pattern identifying approach to this research because, you know, just the complexity of every individual relationship, whether we're talking about one between a scientist and teacher or one between, you know, two friends or two colleagues, you're not going to be able to predict how every individual partnership evolves. However, if I saw a pattern that developed in, say, 12 out of the 14 individuals who I studied, that's a pretty strong trend. So some of the major problems that I saw, at the onset of this partnership program, the roles of each person are very loosely defined. The teacher's role is that of the pedagogical expert, and the CATS fellow's role is that of the science content expert. But those are so general that no CATS fellow went into his or her partnership having a really concrete idea of these are specifically going to be my roles, whether it was day-to-day, in or out of the classroom. I'm not sure what I'm doing, and I'm also not sure about how to initiate conversations with my teacher partners about what I'd like to do. So the lack of role definition was one major problem. Another issue was this concept of welcomed and invited, which what I mean by that is both the cat fellow and the teacher acknowledged what one another was contributing. They acknowledged each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they worked collectively to address those. So one example I can think of is a situation where I observed a CAS fellow working in two different first grade classrooms. In one of the classrooms, when the fellow walked in, the teacher would come over, you know, greet the fellow. They'd talk for just a couple of minutes about what they were going to be doing that day. The fellow would begin the lesson, but the teacher was always engaged in what was going on.
Okay.
She was adding comments to the fellow's, you know, initial introduction of this is what we're doing. She was integral in classroom management, like discipline, for example. Always helped with distributing and cleaning up materials. And while the students were doing their independent work, this teacher was always circulating and answering questions. In contrast, the other classroom this fellow was working in, she would come in, the teacher would sometimes acknowledge her, sometimes not. The fellow would start the introduction to the lesson, and the teacher would usually take that time to work on grading papers or, you know, having her snack.
She was taking a break.
Yeah,
while
taking a break.
The fellow was there, wow.
Yeah, and her engagement was very, very hit and miss in terms of the independent work. When the teacher felt comfortable with the activity that they were doing, like if it was something that she already knew about, she would help. But if it was a topic that she really didn't have a background in or that she thought was boring, she let the fellow just run totally independently. And that lack of engagement is definitely something that can contribute to straining of a partnership.
Does that also affect the students in the class?
Definitely. There's been a lot of previous research that indicates the teacher is kind of a model of learning for the students. And if the teacher is investing him or herself in that particular activity and expressing an interest in that, that interest is going to transfer over to the students, and they're going to say, you know, if this teacher who I've worked with all year and this person who I respect is really excited about this, that's valuable for me, and I'm going to be excited about it too. And, you know, the inverse would also be true. So it's essential for the teacher to be engaged and show that that activity is important and it's interesting.
If the partnership started out with problems, were there ways to change that partnership before it was too late?
Absolutely. There's kind of an inherent power dynamic to the CATS program because most of the CATS fellows start out on average working with 6 or 7 teachers. And across the board, that's just too much. So by the end of their fellowship, on average, a CATS fellow will only be working with 3. So the CATS fellow is basically getting to call the shots about which partnerships are going to be salvaged and which will be terminated. I can think of one example where a CATS fellow started out, you know, in September working with this teacher, and while she seemed really interested in cultivating a partnership, she didn't want to put in the time to plan and collaborate, which is also one of my essential elements of partnership formation. The fellow was really frustrated about this and continued to implement his activities independently for about a month, but then realized, you know, as soon as I'm gone, all science is going to cease in the classroom because the teacher just isn't involved. So he approached her, had a conversation, and I guess you could say gave her an ultimatum and said, if we can't set aside X number of hours per week to plan outside of class, I'm not going to be able to continue. He hadn't communicated that need up until that point, and when this teacher realized, oh, I didn't think that this was one of the important criteria for us working together, of course I'll set aside time, the partnership evolved very successfully after that. So it's definitely it's possible to overcome the majority of these barriers as long as there is honest communication about what needs to be changed.
And that would be one of the approaches then for a successful partnership, communication, and then what else would be important?
Well, the three major patterns that I found in the data in terms of elements conducive to evolving an effective partnership were the desire and commitment to plan together. That included planning collaboration outside of the classroom, as well as establishing a non-hierarchical division of labor during the lesson. What you want to see happening is these roles blending so that by the end of the fellowship, or, you know, ideally before that, the teacher is comfortable with science content and teaching, and the same for the CAPS fellow. So the desire to plan and collaborate, partnership-centered alignment of goals. And what I mean by that is to just go in and say, I want to improve science. Not really concrete enough. There needs to be some discussion of how specifically we're going to be working together to improve the implementation of science in the classroom. Whether that means our goal is to spend this percentage of time on science activities during the day. Our goal is to improve science journals, maybe, and teach students how to make accurate scientific diagrams and write lab reports. Whether our goal is to do more experiments in the classroom, there's got to be some kind of a discussion of specifically how we're going to assess whether or not the science is improving. I did see a lot of CAPS fellows, though, who came into their partnership with either no goals whatsoever or goals focusing on helping the students only or goals focusing on improving their own teaching. And I really found that those kind of goals weren't really conducive to building a relationship because they weren't focusing on the teacher. They were focusing on what can I get out of this, and what can I do for the students? And I mean, it follows that if you're focusing on actually cultivating this relationship, in turn, the students are going to benefit and you're going to benefit. But the primary goal, I found, needs to be centered on the partnership.
And is that the priority of work like this, to make sure that the teacher can take these skills beyond just that fellowship period and use it all the time in his or her future?
Absolutely. One of the principal goals of the CATS program is to have sustainability of this increased quality and quantity of science in the classroom. And like we were discussing before, without intimate planning and collaboration and working together in the classroom, and the teacher kind of taking in some of these science concepts, that sustainability is not going to be there. And it's nobody's fault. It's just, you know, I mean, my background isn't in molecular biochemistry, for example. So if somebody came in and worked with me to develop my knowledge of that, if I wasn't involved, I wouldn't feel comfortable at all once that person was gone doing any of this. So that sustainability is really a key issue, too.
Does this relate in any way to, do you think, to scientists interacting with the general public?
Absolutely. And that, I hope that that's something that I got across in the question and answer session at my Geo Days talk. But I think that these findings are, there are over 70 of these partnership programs in the United States. So I think that my findings are absolutely applicable to these other partnership programs, but I think that we can extend these trends and apply them to collaborations in industry, public policy that involves environmental issues, basically any teamwork endeavor where you're bringing in people with different strengths to work together. One other study that I wanted to point out, and I think this is a major issue in the scientific community, some other researchers looked at a similar partnership program, and they found that at the end of the program, only 20% of the scientists who participated expressed an awareness that their teaching, you know, in their own courses could stand to be improved. So even after all this partnering happens, it's still this paradigm of the scientist coming in and feeling like he or she is there to fix something or to help. And I really think that there has to be that mutual recognition that, you know, I'm giving you a lot of increased science content knowledge, but I need a lot of teaching knowledge from you.
Why is that so hard for a scientist to recognize, do you think?
What do you think? I don't know.
I'm not sure, unless it has to do with a very focused work, not a lot of other people involved in their research, and then suddenly they're trying to bring that to groups of people that maybe they're not used to that.
I think that's one thing. So I think that the very technical specialization and just, you know, this very specialized, you know, language that scientists have, I think that that's one reason why communicating our scientific knowledge to the public, you know, whether it's someone who does have a science background or it's a layperson, it's very difficult. I also think that kind of spirit of isolation in the natural sciences is definitely a contributing factor. And I also think that scientists who are trained in a Research One environment, like we all are, if you look at the pie chart of duties, I think that the research is by far what we're focusing on, and the teaching and the outreach and service, I don't want to say that they fall to the side, but I think that a scientist needs to be a lot more focused on teaching, service, and outreach if that component of his or her job is going to get done.
There's a new movement to try to make journals free. There's some free journals now that the public can access, and I think that may be part of it too, that before you published in a journal that very few people had access to, that kept it limited. Now, though, hopefully things are changing and that scientists will start including in their training and in their research more outreach to the public through journals and then eventually through actually talking to them and education.
Yeah, I think another thing that's going to be really important, you know, hopefully the sooner the better, but definitely in the next decade, is getting current faculty to understand the value of teaching, service, and outreach so that they allow their grad students to, you know, focus a little bit more on their teaching, research, and outreach, and not maybe have as rigid expectations of how much research has to be done in this amount of time. I also think that that journals like the Journal of Geoscience Education, the Journal of Research and Science Teaching, as those become more and more accessible and more people start to learn about the existence of these journals, hopefully that's going to make a difference in terms of opening current faculty members' eyes to the fact that education needs to be a major priority, even at a research university like the U of A.
Or they could react with, I already have enough to do, how am I going to fit in education? How do you think they can fit this into their work?
Well, I think one really important element is that they have to really be invested in incorporating this into their work. I think one of the incentives that they're going to have in the near future to incorporate this into their work is the broader impact section of National Science Foundation grants, because now that broader impact section of your grant proposal is one of the most important things the NSF looks for.
Is that something new?
It's not something new, but before, my impression of grant writing is that, you know, they're looking for cutting-edge research. And they're still looking for cutting-edge research, but there's also this recognition now by NSF that's developing that we really need to ask ourselves, what is the human impact of this research, and how are you going to go about communicating your results to the public? So,
Do you think that also will bring, there's kind of been a chasm that's grown between the humanities and sciences. Do you think that'll hopefully kind of bridge that gap, or it'll just continue?
I mean, I hope so. I don't know if it'll take grant proposals being, you know, rejected or not funded, you know, as heavily as, you know, faculty members want for that to happen. But, yeah, I mean, I definitely hope that this recognition that we need to have better communication skills and we need to be able to convey our knowledge in a more accessible manner will bridge that gap somewhat. But, I mean, at the same time, that means that individuals involved in the humanities are going to have some way to see that the natural sciences are important to their lives as well.
And actually, oftentimes they don't. I've noticed that in my own social sciences and humanities courses where science is rejected outright as, oh, that's too essential or something.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the other things, I was just having a conversation about this a few weeks ago with someone I know who recently got a PhD in the social sciences, and he made the comment that he feels like undertaking a graduate degree, you know, whether it's a master's or a PhD in one of the natural sciences, is a lot easier than the humanities or social sciences because we come in with a research project all set up for us and we just have to do our lab work and it's very laid out, which I definitely don't agree with.
Right.
The week before, though, I was talking with someone who's getting a graduate degree in the natural sciences, and he actually remarked how getting a degree in the humanities or social sciences is so much easier, you know, because it's more right-brained and it's more subjective, and
mm-hmm.
you don't have to worry about lab equipment breaking, you know, and waiting to do field work and that. So I think that there's definitely a disconnect between the, you know, the social sciences and humanities and the natural sciences. And I think that they're two separate cultures, and few people have made an effort to understand the other culture. So
I noticed with my own education when coming in, I had the same sort of belief, and that's why I focused on the natural sciences, but I've learned otherwise, that they can really inform each other.
I think so, too. And I think that a lot of the responsibility is going to fall to graduate students and, you know, very recent master's and PhDs to kind of be ambassadors, I guess, to try to bridge this gap. But, you know, collaborative work, like writing an interdisciplinary grant, for example, I think would be a really good way to start to bridge that gap. And that comes back to developing an effective relationship between individuals from two different cultures. So I think that's another place where my findings could definitely be applicable within the university system, perhaps.
There have been a lot of recent geology events, the tsunami last year, Mount St. Helens, things that have, you know, had a lot of media coverage and a lot of public excitement. That seems like the perfect opportunity to bring science to the public.
It really is the perfect opportunity, and I kept a lot of, you know, newspaper clippings and, you know, watched a lot of the television programs that came about as a result of, you know, like you were mentioning, St. Helens and the tsunami. And one of the things that's really dismaying to me is that a lot of the information that's given to the public by the media is wrong.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that too.
And I mean, some of the information that's incorrect, you know, for me as a geologist, is just nitpicky stuff. I mean, I'm so sick of hearing that plate tectonics only involves the crust, because it doesn't. It's the lithosphere. And I know that that's really nitpicky and maybe not, you know, at the forefront of importance, but there are a lot of misconceptions that are being perpetuated, you know, just in the local papers, but also in documentaries about geology, which I find really upsetting. And that's another reason that I think it would be really beneficial to have some scientists, you know, working in media capacity, trying to make sure that these misconceptions aren't getting filtered through the system.
It's another partnership that should be developed.
Yeah. And I think that that's going to be another significant motivation to increasing public education and awareness in the natural sciences because, for example, if people, after, you know, when the tsunami was coming, had realized that when you get this quick regression of the sea, it's not time to go walk around in the tidal flats and pick up fish and pick up shells. It's time to get to higher ground. And I think a lot of lives could have been saved, you know, just from that awareness.
That's true.
So maybe human casualties will be part of the motivation as well. I worked for the Park Service at Mount Rainier a couple of summers ago, and I was a geologist in the park. My primary responsibility was to lead guided hikes about the geology and the hazards associated with Mount Rainier because it's an active stratovolcano and it's glaciated. And in the recent past, you know, all the way back to, I guess, 5,600 years ago, there have been these huge mud flows, some of which have made their way all the way to Seattle, which is a 2-hour drive. And it was really amazing to me the number of local residents who would come to Rainier and either not realize that Rainier was a volcano or not realize that their homes were built on mudflow deposits. And it was really an eye-opening experience because a lot of people are just clueless about the hazards that they're exposed to just from where they live.
One of the things I enjoy about geology is the fact that it changes your perspective so much. You talk about things that happen, you know, today, but then you also talk about things that happen over periods of millions of years. And maybe if the public saw some of that, there would be less short-term thinking.
Definitely. I think one thing that's going to be really important as geoscience education and communication kind of emerge as these new disciplines, is taking our very abstract knowledge of the Earth and applying it so that people can see it in the real world. As a TA in physical geology right now at the U of A, it's really amazing to see how students' perspectives change after we discuss a certain topic in the lab and then we go out in the field and actually see this happening or
right.
See evidence of this process happening. So I think figuring out some way to portray these concepts to the public so that they can actually look out their window and see what's going on is also really essential.
There's a lot of talk, a lot of debate now about intelligent design versus evolution in schools, and what's your comments on that debate?
I think that this debate represents a really important opportunity to teach students to be critical thinkers and appreciate different points of view, and also to understand how scientific theories and facts are developed. For example, I think that it would be really useful to educate students about different viewpoints, you know, creationism versus evolution, if that's what's chosen to be, you know, woven into the curriculum, but to really focus on, here are all these pieces of scientific evidence that I can show you to kind of support this theory that continues to be a source of debate.
Well, it seems like the whole idea of what a theory is needs to be explained in the first place, because so much of the rhetoric is, it's just a theory. that therefore let's dismiss it when theory is such a foundation to what science is all about.
Yeah, so I mean, as much of a, you know, as strong as my own opinions are on the subject, which I guess I will elaborate on too much, I think that it is really important to teach students to be critical thinkers, and like you said, to use this as a really great opportunity to teach students about the scientific process and the scientific method. And like you said, let's think about what a theory is and how this theory of evolution came to being. Let's look at all of these different pieces of global evidence and study all of these different scientists who have contributed to this body of knowledge that is now, you know, a theory at the forefront of science.
One of the other debates now, there was a comment made by a university president about women in science and mathematics.
I know.
And there's been a lot of flack. I'm wondering, why is this even still an issue?
You tell me. I don't know if I can answer that. It really saddens me to hear all this rhetoric about, you know, equal opportunity employers, and, you know, we value diversity. We're very much an institution that, you know, whose principles are based in equality. And then to hear such a high-level administrator, you know, make a comment like that. I don't know. I think one of the things that's being investigated right now is why the gender ratio in graduate programs is essentially 50-50 and actually even leaning now more toward women. But when you look at who is getting these academic positions, women compose, you know, the very, very small minority. And I've thought about it a lot, and, you know, I don't really know what the answer is. I think that there needs to be a lot more consideration of this issue, and I think that one of the ways to go about that would be to do some research on faculty members, staff members, and graduate students' perception of these gender issues in academia. And I think of, you know, an interdepartmental study, you know, whether it be surveys or interviews among a bunch of different universities would really be valuable.
It's surprising nothing like that's been done yet.
Well, I mean, I think it would be a huge undertaking because you have to get universities interested so that they'll actually take the time and fill out the surveys. You need to have some kind of an outside evaluator. You need to have people communicating with these different institutions who have been trained in the research protocol. And, you know, these are some of the issues that I experienced when I was doing my research because I was pretty much, I was it. And I would really love to see my research continued on a larger scale, but, you know, even a really small project like this where you're trying to compile data, it's a big undertaking. And I think that if there were people at different universities who were really invested in, you know, solving this problem of, you know, lack of gender equity, I think it could be done. But it would also have to be some kind of a longitudinal study, you know, and follow up, you know, in 2 to 5 years after the pilot study was done.
As a graduate student, have you run into any sexism or discrepancies?
Sexism, let's see. So I think one of the issues in geology is physical fitness if you're doing field work. And I think that was always one of my strengths and one of the ways that I was able to prove myself as a woman in this field is that I could keep up with the guys in the field. It's I think a lot of people laugh about this. It's, you know, you look at some of these emeritus faculty or even older faculty members who are in their 60s and 70s, and they can just zip right up, you know, this steep slope. And my ability to do that, I think, was definitely in my favor. I'm trying to think what else in terms of sexism. Since I haven't really been on the job market yet for an academic position, I'm just finishing up a bunch of applications. I haven't faced anything employment-wise, but I've read a lot on the Chronicle of Higher Ed website and heard from some female colleagues that, you know, one of the major issues is if you're applying for a tenure track position, what about children? You know, I mean, is it possible to do cutting edge research, do excellent teaching, have a service component, and have a family? You know, because the tenure process, your packet gets evaluated, I guess, 6 or 7 years after you start the position. And if you have a child, I mean, that's a major chunk of your time budget. So that's an issue that I don't know if I'll face in the future. But in terms of any other sexism, there definitely hasn't been anything explicit. So, but I definitely know people who have experienced it.
I don't know if you want to talk about this in general, but I've kind of been inspired by you knowing that you've had some health obstacles, and yet you keep this level of excitement that's incredible.
Oh,
and
thanks.
You're really a good teacher doing it. Has that been a problem? How do you do it?
Okay. So I'm comfortable talking about this. So how do I do it? I guess when I was in, so the illness began in the fall of 2003, and I am currently having a decent recovery. So I'm kind of out of the woods as far as that goes.
What was the illness?
What they think happened is that I was exposed to some kind of a microbe in the soil, which is totally possible because I've been, you know, all over doing field work and just other outdoor activities. And it's probably a microbe that everyone in the population gets exposed to, but for some reason my immune system reacted really strangely to it. So it started out as a really severe hepatitis, which resolved itself pretty quickly, but right after that happened, my bone marrow failed. And essentially what happened is that my immune system, in wiping out this microbe that was in my system, also wiped out my bone marrow. I was not a very good candidate for a bone marrow transplant because I didn't have a sibling match. So instead, I've done a couple of rounds of what they call immunosuppressive therapy. That basically means my immune system gets killed, and when it grows back, presumably the killer T cells that wiped out my bone marrow have been erased. But since my bone marrow was destroyed, not only does my immune system have to grow back, my bone marrow does as well. So for about a year, I was not here at the U of A. I was back east getting treatment because it's so rare that there are only a couple of places that actually specialize in this. During that year, when I didn't know if there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel, to be honest, I really didn't do a whole lot in terms of keeping my foot in the geology community or the geoscience education community. I am kicking myself now because that would have been a great time to do more on my research and maybe I'd be closer to graduation, but because of all the medication, you know, and the feelings of depression that I had, I guess that wasn't really possible.
Well, you were being confronted by something incredibly different than what you'd experienced
before. And it was very difficult for me to think about the fact that, God, like, I just got into the wrong career, I guess, because I've been working on geology for, like, God, how long? I guess at that point it had been, like, 6 years, and am I ever going to be able to go into the field again and do any field work? I mean, I can hardly walk now, so I certainly wouldn't be able to keep up with people in the field like I could before. But now that I'm back here, I think that being back here and teaching and getting back into my research was one of the most important elements in my recovery. And I think that having a purpose and understanding that, you know, I may have to modify my goals and my abilities somewhat, but that I'm still able to be an outstanding teacher, I think that that really lifted my mood and, you know, aided in my recovery. But I guess the strategy I'm taking now is that I'm really resilient, I love what I do, I have a lot of enthusiasm for it, and even if I'm not going to be able to, you know, be out in the field and complete a really rigorous field-based dissertation, I have a lot of other strengths, and I think that I can contribute in a lot of other ways.
And perhaps the new field work is the classroom and the where these partnerships are occurring that you're currently researching.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very unique strength that I would bring as, you know, either a PhD student or a faculty member at either a university or a community college. But I think that the further away I get from this illness, I might be a little bit more ballsy and decide, you know, I'm really going to have to be careful, but I'm going to reinitiate doing field work. And it's just, you know, I mean, it's a bummer because before, you know, I'd be covered with dirt, you know, legs all cut up, you know, didn't really take hygiene into consideration. So now I have to, you know, I have to wear gloves, and I always have my bottle of hand sanitizer, and I have to be careful about not inhaling the dust, but it's doable. You know, I definitely have to be more careful, but if it's a priority and I love what I'm doing, I will find ways around it.
That's great.
So I guess that's kind of my attitude at this point.
Some of your previous research was in paleomagnetism. Tell me a little bit more about the research that you completed.
So this was some research that I did as an undergrad. I did it at the University of Rhode Island. There is a crater lake in Ghana called Lake Bisantui, and it was produced as a result of some kind of an impact about a million years ago. And the really great thing about this lake is that it's got what we call varved sediments, which means that seasonally you get these very discrete layers of sediment being laid down. And this project, it's a huge collaborative effort. It involves Jonathan Overpeck's group here at the U of A, John King's group, who's the paleomagnetics faculty member at Rhode Island. There are some sedimentology personnel at Syracuse University working on this, and I believe a group at Ohio State, maybe the University of Ohio. But basically, when you have these seasonal sediments being laid down, that has serious implications for our understanding of how climate changed in northern Africa over time. And what my research was looking at was the magnetic minerals in these sediment cores. By looking at the magnetic signal over time, what John King's group is attempting to do is reconstruct the variability of the African monsoon cycle time, which, you know, that has a lot of implications for understanding, well, what is the monsoon system like now? And if we're seeing variations over time, how is anthropogenic climate change contributing to the change in the monsoon cycle? That also has implications for the desertification process that's going on in the Sahara, where you're getting these regions on the margin of the Sahara Desert turning into actually arid land, and what kind of effects that's going to have on agriculture, water resources, and population distribution in Africa.
So if we can study the past history of climate, it might tell us something about the future climate.
Yeah, and it's also going to tell us how humans have, well, if they are, since this is, you know, also a topic of debate these days, if humans are influencing alterations in climate, how much are we doing that? And to compare the climate fluctuations, you know, 27,000 years ago, which was the basal age of the core that I worked on, are the monsoon cycles becoming more pronounced, less pronounced, staying the same, and why is that? Another project that I haven't started the lab work yet with, but that I hope to be able to do a bit on over the summer, is looking at a rhyolite tuff in the Tucson Mountains called the Cat Mountain Rhyolite. There's been a ton of work done that suggests that the Tucson Mountains were associated with the Santa Catalina Mountains, and that there is a huge caldera somewhere in the vicinity of the Tucson Mountains that we don't see anymore.
Oh, I see.
Charles Ferguson, who works for the Arizona Geological Survey, we climbed Cat Mountain a couple of springs ago and collected a bunch of samples as we moved up the section. And now I've got this little box, which I'm taking down, of thin sections that he's made. And if time permits while I'm still at the U of A, we're going to be looking at the mineral composition in the Cat Mountain rhyolite tuff and trying to correlate that unit with a very similar looking unit on the other side of the Tucson Mountains.
Now, is this going to help you determine where exactly that caldera was and what the extent of it?
Yeah, it'll help us to determine, hopefully, the margins of that caldera. The other thing is that the vent, the principal volcanic vent that was responsible for, you know, all these ash flows being laid down, has not been located yet.
No.
So that would also be a very promising potential project for someone who was interested in paleomagnetic applications in volcanology, and also someone who was interested in studying the petrology of ash flow stuff.
This paleomagnetic work, will it help make a more detailed calendar of events that we can compare other events to? I mean, does this have implications for absolute aging of geology, in geology?
Yeah, I think that, I think that the model for the formation of the Tucson Mountains can definitely be applied to other settings, but in terms of paleomagnetic work, there's been quite a bit done, but in terms of locating the actual, you know, the vent that I was talking about, the source of all this material, there's a technique called magnetic anisotropy that has been employed in some systems in New Mexico that possibly could be transferred to this setting. And my understanding of this at this point is pretty rudimentary, but essentially what they've done is look at the alignment of magnetic minerals in some lava flows, actually, that are associated with the system. And, again, a lot more complicated geophysics goes into this, but there's this idea that if you look at the alignment of the magnetic minerals, you can actually look at which way they're pointing, and through some triangulation, you know, very complex methods, these minerals may actually point to the vent, which has since been a
Okay.
So, I mean, this could be a really important study.
Right.
But
the study needs to be done first.
The study needs to be done, and there are also some questions about the validity of magnetic anisotropy studies that would have to be taken into account, but I think by using paleomag and some absolute dating and some, you know, detailed field mapping and some volcanic stratigraphy together, you know, all of those elements could contribute to a greater understanding of this caldera, which I think would be really exciting.
Right.
So, someday.
So, that kind of answers my question about your future plans. It looks like more research. When are you done with your graduate studies, and then what do you want to do after that?
So I will be completing my master's this summer, and essentially, at this point, that's just involving completing a manuscript that will be submitted to the Journal of Geoscience Education, and, you know, ideally that would get published. I definitely have an interest in pursuing a PhD, and what I would like to do, like we've been talking about this whole time, I'm very interested in the human side of geology. And one of the places that I think I could make a really powerful impact would be hazard mitigation. And I'm very interested in volcanology. So ideally what I'd like to do is use detailed mapping, volcanic stratigraphy, and clearly some kind of a dating method to establish an eruptive history for an active stratovolcano. So I'm interested in volcanoes that spit out ash and erupt lava. So if we could understand how a particular volcano has behaved in the past, that would assist us in developing hazard maps as well as evacuation strategies for future eruptions. And I think that an endeavor like that would be really valuable based on, you know, thousands and thousands of deaths that we've had associated with volcanism even in the last decade. I do not plan on going directly to graduate school, both for health reasons and career ambitions, because what I'd really like to do for at least the next several years is to teach at the college level. The U of A actually just opened a lecturer position for this fall, which I hopefully will have applied to by this afternoon or tomorrow morning. So I think that would really be, for me, a dream job. And that would involve teaching introductory geology, which, you know, I've done for several years here at the U of A, and also contributing to some curricular reform in terms of introductory geoscience. I would also be very interested in teaching at the community college level, because in addition to teaching at the introductory level for the more traditional students, I'm also very interested in teaching at the community level and interacting with, you know, quote-unquote non-traditional students who, you know, may be pursuing a second degree but are coming from perhaps a humanities or social sciences perspective, because I think, you know, getting their perspective about the natural sciences and learning from them would also be really valuable for me. But definitely teaching. And again, I'm especially interested in teaching at the introductory level, because I think that I do a good job of getting students excited about going on in geology, and I've worked a lot to make sure that they leave their introductory class with a very broad but very accurate understanding so that they're well prepared for their upper level classes.
Well, it worked in my case.
All right, good. I'm glad.
I decided to pursue geoscience.
Yay! I'm excited.
So, well, good luck with that. You're definitely a great teacher.
Thank
and
you.
Lecturer.
Well, and I'm glad that you got something out of the class when we worked together, because we definitely need more, you know, smart, inquisitive students in the geosciences.
Thank you. Well,
for sure.
Thanks for joining Radio Frontier Channel. I appreciate you sitting down with me.
Oh, well, I was very flattered to hear from you that some of your listeners might be interested in some of the work that I do.
Definitely. Thanks again.
A list of links to information discussed in this episode can be found at the Radio Frontier Channel website at radio.frontierchannel.tv. Look for the link to the Episode 7 show notes. Please call Radio Frontier Channel at 206-202-3311 or email frontierchannel@frontierchannel.tv with your comments. Thank you for listening, and please join me next time for more news and commentary from the frontiers of science and technology.